Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Welcome to the OC Bitches today.
Welcome to the OC Bitches. Apparently, I haven't been saying that strong enough, according to a few people. I don't know. I haven't been owning it, so I'm owning it.
Why don't you just welcome. Do it like Carmack way?
Okay. Welcome to the OC Bitches. This is how it's done in Orange County.
Yep. Every episode, yep. That's how you're going to have to start it from now on. Thank you for that. Okay. Appreciate it. How are you? Other than not delivering a punchful, punchful? Is that a word?
I'm punchy. Well, yes. Okay. I think you're pretty famous for making up words. Clawfus, punchful.
Clawfus, yep. Mm-hmm. In the clawfus. Actually, today, my clawfus is clearly a clawfus because I'm packing for a trip and I have clothing hanging in the background.
Oh my gosh, what a cute dress.
Oh, thanks.
Who's the designer?
Actually, you know what? That is a fancy one. But it's a Dolce and Gabbana, mm-hmm. But I got it at TJ Maxx. So high and low end.
Oh my, are you, I need some shopping tips. You know where to go or you happen to say, I'm going to check into TJ and see
what's up. Well, there's certain TJs that have fun sections that have some designer clothing. I'm a true Maxinista.
I never knew that. Good to know.
Mm-hmm. Runway
today
section.
We are super, super excited. Well, let's just invite our guest in.
Let's do it.
Hey.
Hey. Hi. It is so great to see your face.
Hi.
So everyone, crazy. This is Norman Buckley, and I have an intro that I'd like to share with our guests. Our guests, or with our listeners about our guest. Our guest today is the one and only Norman Buckley. He is a passionate, multi-talented filmmaker, director, producer, and editor. He first began as an assistant editor on 3 Oscar-nominated films, Tender Mercies, Silkwood, and Places in the Heart. He was our beloved editor for the OC pilot and 30 episodes after, and then became our beloved director, which means he is responsible for many iconic moments on the OC, including music choices and the epic moment at the end of this ep. He went on to direct a few shows you may have heard of, Pretty Little Liars, Gossip Girl, Charmed, Chuck, Heart of Dixie, keeping it in the family. And that is only naming a few. He is currently the co-executive and directing producer of Netflix's Sweet Magnolias, and we are honored to have him here. Welcome, Norman.
Woo-hoo. Thanks. Hey. It's so nice to be with you guys. I'm sorry we couldn't do it sooner. I was really appreciative that you guys wanted to have me on your podcast, which I've listened to and aww. Is so much fun. It's such a trip down memory lane.
Oh, yeah. Aw, thanks, Norman. We're so happy you're here. Thank you for making time to come and talk to us. Oh, yeah.
No, it's fun.
When I was preparing for this, I just kept thinking about the fact that, you know, writers write a script. And then you guys prepare for the show and actors learn their lines. We go on set, the grip's gripped, the electric's electric, and everything's shot. And then it's all handed to you in post-production and you put it together in this beautiful package, little bow. And you've contributed to so many moments of this show that I'm so excited to deep dive into that today.
Oh, well, you know, it was such an important part of my life. It was life-changing, truly, because I did start as an editor, and then I transitioned to directing on the OC, and that's now what I've been doing for the last 18 years. So it's it was a real pivotal point for me to work on the show.
You've been pretty busy this past 18 years.
Well, it's pretty crazy. It kind of took off. I started directing in the second season of the OC, and then I directed more in the third season. Then I was only directing in the fourth season. I don't know if you guys remember this, but I directed second unit on the series finale, And I directed both of you out of the show, I think. I directed the scenes that were your last scenes for both
no
of you.
Way.
I'm pretty sure about that. Yeah, Ian Toyton was the director, but there was so much in that finale that they brought me in because they were doing a double unit. So I think I directed both of your last scenes on the show, if I'm not mistaken. God. Yeah.
Well, so that's really cool.
I'm really disappointed that neither of you remembers that, but that's okay.
No, Mindy can attest that I don't remember anything, so please don't take offense to it. I didn't know there's some characters that die in it. Like, I was like, what happened? So.
Well, it's so funny to go back and watch it again. I watched the episode we're talking about today, or watched it the other night, and I was like, oh, wow, this show really holds up. It's really fun to watch, you know? It's been a long time, and I've forgotten about a lot of it, but I really enjoyed it, and I thought the writing was so sharp, and I actually was very happy with my editing work in this particular episode. I thought, I wouldn't do it any different, which is a really great thing to feel as you're looking at something, you know. I thought it was really elegant, actually. I enjoyed this episode a lot, which Michael Fresco directed. And I was so fortunate in the sense that I worked with some of these guys like Patrick Norris and Ian Toyton and Michael Fresco and Michael Lang mm-hmm. and Tony Warmby. And all of them were so generous with me in terms of mentoring me to prepare to direct, and I owe such a great debt of gratitude. I just thought this episode was really elegantly directed by Michael Fresco, and I remember working on it with him, and so many of the shots are designed so beautifully. They're just, mm-hmm. just these beautiful handoffs, and I was impressed with how, like I said, it held up really well. It was a really fun episode to watch. So it didn't feel like homework.
Well, that's good. We had a lot of really just kind directors too. And I think that really
absolutely.
Was fortunate. Just very cool, kind, talented, yourself included, of course. And we were very fortunate in that way. I know we're talking about the episode today. I'm going to read the synopsis just so people know what we're talking about with all of the elegant editing and everything else along with it. It's The Countdown, which is the New Year's Eve episode where New Year's Eve looms and Ryan blows it when Marissa says those three little words and he can't say it back. She heads to Oliver's penthouse for a New Year's Eve party. And when Ryan realizes he should go too, he gets locked in the pool house thanks to Seth's Aunt Haley, who came to town and then used the Cohen's house to throw an out-of-control party. Sandy and Kirsten accidentally attend a swingers party and contemplate staying. That is the synopsis.
I thought there was so much humor in this episode. Yeah. It was really light. Just when it was could have been, because the last episode, there was some a little bit of drama with Marissa and Ryan, but it was very light and fun.
I agree.
It was light and fun. And the one big thing that I question, though, is that Haley locks them into the pool house. What kind of pool house would have a lock on the outside? That part was a little puzzling to me.
There was a couple puzzling things. Yeah.
Has a lock on the outside. So they lock Ryan in at night, I guess.
They probably, no, Kirsten had those put on when they accepted Ryan into the family. Just lock him away.
but before we get too much into the episode, there's a few things that I know about you and your origins with the OC that you started on Fastlane, right? With McGee.
Yes,
and that's how you ended up coming to the OC. And also, one of the other things that I've come to understand, at one point I asked Rachel about a music choice, and she asked Josh about it, and he said, I think that was Norman's idea, and I realized how much editors have an influence on the music. You also introduced Alex Patsavas to Josh, is that true?
Yes, I'd worked with Alex on a couple of independent films, and
our music supervisor.
I thought her musical taste was very much in sync with Josh's. We were initially, you know, all looking for music for various scenes, and I just suggested that he meet with her because I thought that she definitely had an aesthetic that I thought he would respond to, and she would provide us every week these remarkable CDs full of music. And they were usually bands that hadn't even broken yet. So it was a great process of discovering new bands and new music. And she introduced me to Imogene Heap. There's just a lot of music that I've grown to really love over the years. I still listen to some of these things. They're still on my playlist. Occasionally an OC playlist will pop up. And I still really enjoy a lot of the music from that period of time. But yeah, it was an exciting process because of the fact that we were given pretty much free rein. Matt Ramsey and I used to fight over songs. You know, we'd find some really great song and then we'd get into these duels about who was going to be able to use it and whose episode.
Did you win?
No, frequently I did not because Matt would really make the case to Josh that it would play better in his episode than mine. So there were some times where I was stymied by Matt, the speed with which Matt made it to Josh and claimed certain songs. You know,
I'm interested in that process. Does Alex find music, get them approved somehow, and then you have a list that you as an editor can listen to and just have it in your library?
She just constantly was replenishing our musical library. So we would get these CDs from her and then we would just put the music into the Avid and then we would have it. There was something that we started doing on the show. I don't remember it ever being done on another show before. Perhaps it was, but I feel that we kind of broke ground in this area in the sense that she would also get us the instrumental tracks of various songs so that we'd actually integrate the instrumental tracks into the scenes in such a way that you would build that as part of the score. And I don't remember it ever being done on a television series before the OC. I like to claim it anyway, because it was a real, it was a real elegant way of keeping the motifs from the various songs alive throughout an episode. And mm-hmm. So, for instance, you'd hear a little bit of the song, you'd hear a little bit more of the song at another point, and then you'd build into the song later. And then that was something that we continued to do on Gossip Girl when I went on to Gossip Girl and worked on that show. I worked on the OC, and then I started directing on both Chuck and Gossip Girl, and then later went on to Heart of Dixie for one episode. I kind of branched out from into the Josh Schwartz, Stephanie Savage universe. And Lila Gersten, who did Heart of Dixie, mm-hmm. was part of the OC writing staff, mm-hmm. and I think wrote a couple of the episodes that I directed. So it was a wonderful way to kind of build a career under the auspices of my patrons, and they really took care of me. But that it was great to see just a lot of the things that we experimented and tried on the OC kind of grow into those other shows as well. So I had a great relationship with Stephanie Savage because of Fastlane. I'd worked with McGee on Fastlane, and McGee originally was going to direct the OC. Early in the prep process, that was the intent, was that he was going to be the director of the OC as well. And they brought me in to meet with Josh to edit the pilot. And then McGee left the project. And they just told Doug Liman, well, this is the guy you're using, because I'd already been hired to be the editor. And I'll never forget the first time I cut a scene that I showed to Doug Liman was the carjacking at the top of the pilot. Uh-huh. And I showed it to him and he looked at it and he said, that's the worst thing I've ever seen. I can't remember ever seeing a scene that was cut as badly. I don't even know what to say about it. It's so bad.
Oh my gosh.
And I sat there and I thought, okay, well, I know that I'm a good editor, so I'm just going to let that comment go and I'll just show him another scene. And then I showed him the scene of you, Rachel, entering the party at the beach house, yeah. Coming down the driveway at the beach house. And he said, that scene is perfect. Don't touch a frame of it. It's perfect just the way it is. And so I thought, okay, this is a guy who's going to tell me what he thinks, completely uncensored,
yep.
completely without yep. any filter. I will just always know exactly what he thinks. So it made it really easy to work with him. I edited the pilot with him, and then also the first episode, he directed that as mm-hmm. well. And I always knew if he liked something or if he didn't like something right away, because he would tell me.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget that.
Yes, that's for sure.
but it was great. It was great because it was a situation where I knew exactly where he stood in relationship to what I was showing him. So I was able to very quickly make whatever adjustments that he wanted.
You know, my favorite thing to ask our, you know, editors or you in particular is who wound up on the cutting room floor the most?
We asked that to Matt.
Yeah. We did.
I don't.
No filter, Norman.
I don't remember there being those kinds of issues because everybody was very good. I think that the hardest thing for me was that we had to cut the episodes to a very specific time. Any network television show with commercials has to be cut to, I don't know what it is.
42 like minutes. Yeah.
Something like that. 42 minutes and 35 seconds. Or it's some very specific number. And I do remember that there were times where I would feel very frustrated that we were losing certain grace notes, certain things where a moment just might breathe because we just had to get it down to that specific time. And it's one of the things that I really enjoy about working, the show I'm working on right now is for Netflix, where we don't have those commercial breaks that we're trying to cut the material to. So there's a little bit more freedom in terms of crafting a moment so that it really plays beautifully as opposed to it's got to fit this pocket. And I do remember one episode in particular where there was a really beautiful exchange between
25 years ago, Carrie Bradshaw started posing a slew of honest, provocative, relatable questions to the modern woman in her fictional column, Sex and the City. And just like her, the singles and hopeless romantics of New York still want to know, can you change a man? What constitutes cheating? And can you be friends with your ex? I'm Tara Llewellyn. You may know me from Gilmore to Say, a Gilmore Girls podcast. And after 10 years of navigating dating, friendships, career shifts, heartbreak, and of course, love in New York as Carrie did, I couldn't help but wonder, how relevant is Carrie's column 25 years later? Join me as I revisit this beloved series with some of my favorite New Yorkers and closest friends as we commiserate on first dates, one-night stands, love lost, friendship breakups, and everything in between, to bring Carrie's column to life and answer her questions from each episode of Sex and the City through a modern lens in my new weekly podcast, And Just Like Her.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.
Ben and Misha. And I just hated losing it because I thought it was just so wonderfully played. And I can't remember that. I mean, I would recognize the episode if I saw a list of the episodes. So I'll get that for you. But there was a really beautiful moment that was back and forth between them. It was all subtext, and it just played so beautifully. And I had to cut it out, and I was very, very unhappy about that. I really enjoyed the moments where there was subtext, as clever and as wonderful as the dialogue was, one of the things I love about the show too is it's very visual. And there would often be these music montages where you would see characters going from place to place. I remember one in one of my episodes where it was just touching in on everybody at the end of the show and played really beautifully over this song. So it was that kind of moment that we had to lose, which I was really disappointed about because it was so well done.
I remember going through the production offices and the time that you said, Melinda, come in here. And you just put together the Luke coming to Julie's door while she's listening to Bob Seger.
Well,
we played Who Would You Do? What was the game? Or Who Would You if you Could? And he goes on to explain you were the coolest mom and you always won. And Julie says, I beat Kiki or Kirsten. And he says, Julie, you're a total MILF. And she takes a sip of wine, and you were just so tickled, and we all giggled. There's a bunch of people actually in the room looking at the scene, and then they ended up making us cut the MILF line because I think it was one of the first times they used that word. But
there were a lot of things that came down from the network. The network notes are always rough. I was very lucky. I feel that it remains for me one of the great creative experiences of my life because I was – I was involved at the pilot stage, and I ended up directing 6 episodes over the run of the series. I edited I don't know how many. And then, as I said, I directed second unit on the series finale. So I was with it from the very, very beginning to the very end. And I was just very appreciative of how much involvement they let me as an editor have in the show. I will always be grateful to Josh and Stephanie for that, because it was a very fertile period of time. I mean, there were, you know, we were shooting down in Manhattan Beach, and I lived in Hollywood, and there were nights where I would drive home, and, you know, that was a long drive, and Josh and I would be on the phone all the way from the time I left Manhattan Beach to when I got home, just trying to figure out how we could make the show better and better. And I really missed that collaboration with those guys, because it was quite extraordinary. And they would spend a lot of time in the editing room with me, and I would spend a lot of time on the set with the various directors. And I just feel that it was such a creatively wonderful time for me from the very beginning all the way through. And I miss those days. I was really disappointed when the show was canceled after only 4 seasons, because I would certainly have liked it to have gone another couple.
Right. I me too. I've been honest about that. I would have liked it to continue. But I was looking.
I know some people are ready to move on to greener pastures. But, yeah.
I would have stayed. Hey, I would still be in the OC right now if I had was given the opportunity, you know, Bluebell right. And Orange County.
It was just definitely a really wonderful period of time. And I do think, look, the show had hills and valleys, but I always just enjoyed the process of trying to figure it out, just trying to figure out how to. The thing that I love about the show more than any other is the mix of comedy and pathos. Like, it moves really deftly back and forth between being very, very funny and very, very sad and melancholy at the same time. In a way that I just think really speaks to a lot of people's experience of growing up. And I remember Stephanie Savage saying something one time that's always stayed with me, because the teen drama has now kind of become my niche. I've moved from teen show to teen show to teen show to teen show. And I have a real facility at that. One of the things that she said that just really stayed with me throughout my career is that everybody can relate to this show. Some people won't be able to relate to a show like Mad Men because it's too sophisticated, or it has, you know, some people won't be able to relate to Game of Thrones because they're not into fantasy. But everybody knows what it's like to be an adolescent. Everybody knows what it's like to be a teenager and be dealing with your parents. And I think that was the success of the show. And that's why it still resonates now. I'm surprised at the number of people who are just finding it and talking about it to me, because I have a fairly large social media following because of all the various shows I work on. And a lot of these kids who have been fans of something like Pretty Little Liars are just now discovering the OC and streaming. And it's very fun to see them kind of discover the show and find that it still really resonates with them as well.
You know, the opening of this particular episode speaks to exactly what you were just saying. It was, you know, as Marissa and Ryan start, or as the first opening scenes here, they they have this kind of, she's talking about something that was pretty dramatic in the last episode where she was drunk and he got scared, but they're kind of making light of it. And it's this very, then that's where he says, and then she shoplifted, she got drunk and she almost got arrested for drunk driving. But somehow they make it humorous. It's not the normal opening for an episode. Do you agree? Usually they were in the Cohen kitchen.
Yeah, I like the fact that it's very sweet and sincere, and then it's kind of turned on its head when he says thank you. I love the playfulness of that, and even the music changes. You know, there's this musical theme that was kind of the Ryan and Marissa theme throughout the run of the show, and then all of a sudden it turned on a dime and became a little more goofy. But I also just think it sets the tone for the episode. The whole episode is about what is the nature of love, and how hard it is to express that. And I think it plays out. I think it's a beautifully crafted episode. I wrote Josh a note the other night after I watched it and just said, gosh, it's so beautifully written, because it's really about the nature of love, mm-hmm. and the Kirsten and Sandy stuff, and really deciding whether or not they want to go outside of their relationship, which I don't believe that either one of them ever really wanted to do, as much as they were just trying to feel some excitement on New Year's Eve. The Seth and Summer and Anna triangle, the disconnect between Marissa and Ryan, all of it is basically circling around that initial idea that's presented in the first few moments of the show. So I love that the structure of the episode, I just think, is so excellent. And even the stuff with Haley, you know, I love the way that she, through the body of the episode, is presented as kind of a mischievous comic character, but then she has the really serious scene with Kirsten towards the end, where you realize that her life is a little bit devoid of something. So I love the way that the episode began and started with that discussion about what it means to say I love you to another person. And I thought that both Misha and Ben played it beautifully. Mm-hmm. I love the exchange between them. It felt very real.
The brutal thank you in response. Just yeah.
And then the callback to it at the very end of the episode, when she says really it cute. At the very end. I love the way that the episode comes full circle. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful script.
Yeah, I mean, this whole episode was just, I loved watching it, and I cried. I may have teared.
You too?
Tears. Yeah.
Rachel cries a lot.
I do cry a lot, but...
but that's sweet.
I do think that final 5 minutes of it is quite wonderful, just in terms of the use of the high-speed camera, the slow motion, rather. The touching in on each one of the characters, I thought it really built to this emotional crescendo. It's one of the reasons why, when you gave me the list of episodes that we could do on a podcast, it's one of the reasons I picked this, is because I love the way that this episode ends.
Well, yeah. That's a very iconic sequence that you put together with Ben running in there.
Yeah, the slow-mo run. To Marissa.
I got some really great sequences to cut over the run of the show. I did this one, which has tended to show up a lot on fan favorite lists. Mm-hmm. And then I also did the shooting of Trey at the end of season two, which is a huge sequence, you know, which has lived in infamy since then.
On SNL.
yeah.
Dear Sister. And
I like the fact that I got some really great sequences to cut. And as I said, it feels fun to look back on it and go, well, there's not much I would do different there. I think it does play really well. There's things. It's always hard when you're like, I teach a class at UCLA sometimes, and I showed a sequence of a movie that I cut, which I had remembered as being really well edited. And then I showed it in class, and as I was watching it, I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. Oh my God, it's so embarrassing that I'm showing this to students. And the lights came up at the end, and one of my students raised her hand, and I said, yes. And she said, if you had it to do over again, would you do anything differently? And I said, just everything. I would just do the whole thing differently now. It was so funny, because in my mind, it was so well edited, and then when I saw it, it was just so overcut. But I didn't feel that way about this show. I felt really good about the way that it was edited. And I loved the way the music was used throughout. I loved all the performances. I thought that everything about it was working very, very well.
You know, going through this whole episode, there's so much in it. And like you said, Mindy, it was fun and it was light and everything. And there's so many references that date the show.
Yes.
You think?
Oh my gosh. Like
Friendster.
How about Carson Daly and TRL? I mean, I don't even know if people know what TRL is anymore, but it was such a big part of that time. Like, I remember going on TRL and it was like the thing, you know? And like,
Russell Crowe.
Russell
Crowe references. Yeah.
Everybody said
At the time, everybody was saying that Ben McKenzie looked like a young Russell Crowe, right. Which was what that I think this might have been one of the first episodes that was really commenting on its on the show itself. You know,
yeah, it developed that. We were,
yeah, that
that made a of, humor. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, but I think Ben has aged a little bit better than Russell Crowe now. So,
and no more comparing.
Oh, but you know what I found out? I couldn't help but say, Amanda Righetti was a great, you know, she's Haley. She was a great addition to the show. I thought it was a character as I was watching. I could relate. We've all had those moments where it's like, I just want to have fun. And I thought it was fantastic what Kirsten said. You just want to have fun. How's that working out for you? And there have been moments in our lives where we're like, I just want to have fun. And then the fun just, you know, gets a little bit too tiring.
That was a rager that she threw.
Right. No, and it's I for some reason I really related to her. But did you know she was only 20?
What?
And in this episode?
No.
Yes, she was born in 83.
She's younger than me.
Yes.
She felt very sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
Like later when she became Tate's love interest, I had no problem with that.
Right.
Because that felt to me like something I thought, I totally buy it. But I remember Bob De Laurentiis is saying, she's too young to be Tate's love interest in this show. And I was like, really? I kind of really enjoyed that whole storyline. But I think that she had a more sophisticated vibe. She did not feel like 20 years old.
No.
I cannot believe she was younger than me.
I was aware she was younger, and then I was like, I'm going to check this last night. At first it looked like 19, and my jaw dropped, and then I was like, oh my goodness.
I enjoyed the whole storyline with Jimmy and Haley. I thought that it worked, but I remember there being some debate about whether that was really an appropriate connection or not, or whether Haley should just be more in the world of the kids rather than the adults.
Right.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about, though, Rachel, is I remember, I don't know if you remember this, but when the first episode I directed, it was like they threw me in the deep end and they decided, because I'd complained about so many things to Josh, I was just like, you know, why isn't it more like this? Why is it more like that? And so it was just like they gave me everything that they could give me in terms of a challenge for the first episode. And I don't know if you remember this, but there was a big auction sequence in the first episode I directed. And I decided there wasn't enough beats of the auction. And so I just had you and Misha start doing things up on the stage, like presenting various things and holding up various things. And none of it was scripted. And you guys were looking at me like you thought I was completely crazy.
On Valentine's Day 1929, a group of gangsters was massacred in a cold Chicago garage. The crime shook the country. And even though investigators had only just started looking for answers, everyone was sure they already knew who was behind the crime. Al Capone. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, a child of Italian immigrants sets out to make good on the promises of that dream. But Al Capone's path to success doesn't take him down the straight and narrow. Instead, he transforms himself from a smarter-than-your-average thug into the most infamous criminal America has ever known. Listen to American Criminal Al Capone wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
And I remember even Adam at one point acted like he thought this was just going to be a giant clusterfuck, you know, and everybody didn't know what I had in mind, but I had it so well edited in my head. I knew exactly what I was cutting from and what I was going to be cutting to. So I was just having people do these various things.
How funny.
And I've since gotten much better as a director. Now I don't throw people into the deep end like that and just ask them to swim with me. But
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at caskers.com.
It was fun. And so I got great stuff because you and Misha were up on the stage basically just holding up random objects for this auction because I just wanted to create this little montage of this auction. But I just remember you having such a puzzled look on your face the whole time. You were just like, I don't really know what's happening, but okay, I will go along with it. You don't remember that?
I don't. But again, don't take offense.
Well, I just remember by the time I started directing, I was so well versed in what worked on the show and what didn't. And I remember arguing with an AD one day because I was saying, no, I want people moving. I want him moving this direction. I want all the background extras moving that direction. And he said, that doesn't make any sense. I was like, it doesn't have to make sense to you. Just do what I say because I know what it's going to look like. You know, so there was a lot of that. I had to learn to be a little more articulate with the crew and with the cast about why I was doing things. But that first episode that I did, I was just I just was trying to get the cuts I wanted. And I wasn't even explaining to Adam. There was this whole big thing in my episode about the they'd stolen the risky business egg from this auction. Trey had stolen it. And Ryan and Adam had to go and get it back. And so I was duplicating all of these shots from Risky Business. And I didn't explain that to anybody. I was just doing it. I was just saying, just fall down on your elbows and catch this crystal egg, not realizing that I was trying to duplicate a shot from Risky Business. But there was a lot of that sort of thing that I, you know, the OC was like a school for me. It was yeah, like an opportunity for me to learn on the job with a group of people that really cared for me and were willing to go down whatever wormhole I was wanting to take them down. Another thing that happened on the very first episode that I directed, the very first day, I was just standing there on the set and I looked over at Ian Toyton and he was like, say action. Because I just forgot to say action. I was just watching, just waiting for things to just start. And I was so nervous that I broke into a flop sweat. I mean, it was just pouring off of me. I was sweating and my shirt had gotten so wet that it was just clinging to my body. And I remember thinking, this is so humiliating. And there's nothing I can do about it. Because if I run and hide, then it's all over. I'll never direct again. You know, so I just have to stand here in my humiliation and just weather it. But everybody was so kind to me and nobody made fun of me. So it was a nice place to begin my directing career because I felt very loved and protected by the cast and the crew.
Such an advantage. Mostly. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. I'm just saying, I think we all felt that way. And then I said, oh, wait, mostly.
Mostly.
It was such a family. It was such a nice group of people and such a family. And I did really enjoy it when people came up into the editing room and would spend time up there. And I love the fact that that was something that Josh and Stephanie actually encouraged. They were fine with actors coming up and hanging out and seeing scenes and watching things. It really created the space for us to do our best work in the editorial department as well, because we knew everyone. And I really do miss that experience.
You know what? I
don't miss editing very much, but I miss that kind of part of the,
Norman, I told Josh that we were recording with you and he said, say hi. And then he also just said, Dice, at the end of the episode, one of my favorite music drops we ever did.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah. And that shows, like I said, it shows up a lot on 10 best moments from the OC. So
I that's where I cried. Yeah. I even made a note of it. Like roll the dice, which, you know, I didn't know the actual title.
I feel pretty certain that that was scripted. Josh would oftentimes script some of these songs into the show. And I feel pretty certain that that was one that he scripted into the show.
Well, because, considering he claims that it's one of his favorite ever, I'm sure he will take the credit for
it. Yeah. Well, that was one of the things that he was really brilliant at, was finding a musical analog to the nature of a scene. So the pilot was full of musical references that we did use. And he oftentimes would find songs on those CDs by Alex, and he would flag certain songs for certain scenes. So I would say, I want to use this here. And he'd say, no, I'm saving that. Mm-hmm. For instance, Hide and Seek.
Yeah.
He knew as soon as he heard the song Hide and Seek that he was going to use it for Caleb's funeral and then for the end of the episode where Marissa shoots Trey.
Right.
So that was something that he held back for the whole season, knowing that he was going to use it at the end of the season. But he had a great ear for how a song would play against the scene. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think he told me one time that he would even write scenes listening to music, so that it would get him into the spirit of certain scenes.
I think that we can't talk about this episode without acknowledging Oliver, and one of the most beloved characters ever on the OC, because he only showed up at the end of Chrismica, right, in the therapist's office, and then now he's here. And I thought it was such a great storyline. I'm going to be honest. I like the storyline, and I think Taylor Handy did a great job.
Well, clearly he did.
He did a great job too.
Stand him. So that was, you know,
yeah.
Right. It's one of those things too that I love the way that he's talking about the girlfriend that turns out to be, I guess she's an imaginary girlfriend. Is that not correct?
I can't remember
where the story, I know that he goes crazy in the subsequent episodes, but I was trying to remember the girlfriend that he's describing as girlfriend.
Natalie, she's the concierge at the hotel.
Is she?
Yeah, she ends up being the concierge at the hotel.
Oh, okay. So she is,
I forgot that part.
There was a great scene at the party, and I just wanted, when Taylor or Oliver and Marissa are talking, and he's talking about Natalie, Misha was set in a light that was so stunningly beautiful.
Yeah, she looked so beautiful.
Like old Hollywood. Not a lot of actresses can handle that light, but it was, I had to stop on it and frame it, freeze frame it. It was so beautiful. Do you remember that scene that I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. And she was lit really beautifully, but she also was just an extraordinary, I think still is. I mean, I love Misha. I have great affection for Misha. And I think that she definitely had a movie star face. You know, she just had one of those faces that's just like you couldn't get enough of it on the show. It's just like just seeing her in those shots where she's just sitting there looking. That's why I say that when you asked me about what was cut out, it pained me to cut out scenes of her that were just beautifully lit, because she is like an old movie star. Oh, she's just got that face. She looks like that. She looks like something out of the 1930s almost.
Yep. Absolutely. Know,
where just the lighting is all of the planes of her face. Just there's somebody, a director I worked for as an editor once told me, he said, the difference between film actors and stage actors is that you can be a really, really good actor, but to be a great film actor, your face has to reflect the light. And some people's face absorbs the light. And so you could be a really great actor, but if you don't have, if the planes of your face are not just so that it reflects the light back, you're not going to make it as a film actor. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. And I think it's one of the reasons why you see certain people who are just great to look at having these gigantic careers, even if there are some people who maybe for instance, Julia Roberts is one of those people, you know, it's just like her face just reflects the light right back to you. And Misha's very much that way. I agree with you about the scenes of her at that party are wonderful.
As we gain experience, I know if the lighting's going to be good or not for myself. A lot of actresses know that. It's like, oh, I need my China ball, or I need light coming this way, or this isn't great light, you know, especially like outdoors. But Misha didn't matter. There are just some people that it doesn't matter what the lighting is. She's always going to shine. But I mean, that's...
And I think it's one of the things too, and I'm sure that you know what I'm talking about, when there are some actors that just don't make it in the business because they don't understand the importance of hitting marks. And I'm sure you've been in scenes with actors who are suddenly in your light. And who,
I move them. I do this to them.
No, there's always scenes where you like, start to move your head just to like find the light, and you're like, wait, why are you all the way over there?
I remember taking this one actor by the shoulders, and I said, "Do you see that?" And I just move him back and forth. I said, "Do you see that? That's you. You're putting that shadow on her face right now." It's the difference between somebody who really has a facility for being able to work on a film or a television show, is to be able to master not only the acting and the ability to be authentic in front of the camera, but to hit the marks,
and the technical aspect.
Yeah, no, it's funny.
Absolutely. And to hold those two things, which are coming from two different hemispheres of your brain, right, at the same time. And I think that people don't understand just how hard it is to be an actor, because that's the key. That's the ticket, is to be able to master that technical side, but to do it in such a way that it doesn't interfere with you just being completely authentic and unselfconscious in front of the camera.
Right.
It's a huge feat, and people don't understand how hard it is.
Long form television lends itself to just doing it over and over again, and we become proficient in that technical aspect.
It trains you.
Sometimes, yeah, it would be the younger actors, for instance, love her to death, Willa Holland, would when she first started, there were many times where I just would just shift her, because I could see, if I can't see the camera over her shoulder, or if her head's in front of the frame, or I could tell that she's in my light, it's just a little nudge, and that just comes with experience. So young actors won't know that until they do it.
Right.
And television is a great, great training ground. I also did soaps. So you have, soaps are like, you have to know where the camera is and it's moving and that kind of stuff. But yeah.
Yeah. I remember.
Yeah. It's a real skill.
It really is.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that's exactly right. Television is like a training program with all the technical stuff. And it's kind of hard to shift, because movies, there's sometimes a little more freedom, even though it's generally the same idea. It's a little different than television because it's so precise. And well, I guess it depends on the show and the style, but you know, it's, you just get really well trained, and it's like a machine, and you're just like a robot in one sense, and then like you said, both sides of the brain, and then you're being creative with the other stuff. But just to be able to have it second nature is what it becomes, right? Wouldn't you say, Mindy? It's like just there.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when we first, well, most people don't learn a stick shift nowadays, but it takes a little bit of time, but eventually you just do it automatically.
The other thing about television is that you're doing so many pages per day. Mm-hmm. And that's the difference between what you're doing on a film. On a film, you may be shooting 2 pages a day, and that's a big day. Mm-hmm. Whereas on a television show, you're doing 6 to 8. And it's very, very, I think that people don't understand just how hard it is, because you're moving so quickly. And I always say, 5 minutes an hour on a 12-hour day is a full extra hour of shooting. So I know how some directors will go in and read the scene before, you know, you launch into it. I just hit the ground. I'm just like, you stand here, you stand here, you stand here, and let's go and see what happens. Because every 5 minutes you save, that over a 12-hour day is adding up to a full extra hour of shooting.
Wow.
And I think that what you're hampered by when you have an actor who can't hit their marks, or an actor who can't remember their lines, or you know, is constantly freezing up and asking for a line, is those little tiny bits of time add up during the day, and that puts you further and further behind.
Hmm.
And you just don't have the luxury to kind of say, oh, we'll come back tomorrow and finish it, because you have a whole another 8 pages to do the next day. And so television acting is so precise. I remember you both being very, very technical actors, though. it may have been your first show, but you just instinctively knew how to do it then, because you were a total pro, as I remember. And Melinda was just always like, there wasn't even always a need for a second take, because she would nail it on the first.
That's the perfectionist, over-prepared version of me. I was very rarely on the blooper reel. Because I always thought that was time is money, you know. And I know that to a fault, that every time you go, in fact, if I ever did go up on a line, it was just the most awful feeling. I mean, once a month or something that could happen, but I felt terrible when that would happen. So it was just ingrained in me. In this episode, can I ask your guys' opinion of the swingers party storyline? Mm-hmm. I texted with Kelly last night. I asked her what she thought about the swingers party, and she said, oh my gosh, when she first read the script, that she didn't know how to make it work, and that she thought it was so out of character. And knowing Kelly, she very much stands up for her stuff. She said there was abundant discussion with Josh, and then I watched it, and well, first of all, you were talking about risky business. I noticed that the music almost had this kind of risky business, you know, when you were cutting to the eyes up close. And that it had that, I was like, what does this music remind me of? Something 80s. And it sounded to me like Risky Business, like that feeling. And there was just kind of a very awkward, uncomfortable ooh factor to that whole storyline. What did you think?
Well, I think that the inspiration, if I'm not mistaken, for that whole storyline was The Ice Storm was a movie that was popular either right before the OC or thereabouts. I can't remember when The Ice Storm came out, but I know that was the idea of it. Certainly that whole sequence was very racy, you know, in terms of what you would expect on a teenage drama. But yeah, the music, I can't remember what the music was that I used there, but I was always trying to think in terms of using music for the adults that was different than the kids. You know, I was always trying to find music that would play the adult scenes with a different flavor than, and I oftentimes was hearkening back to, I know later in season one, there's some stuff that's taken from Breakfast at Tiffany's. I was always taking music to Josh and Stephanie and saying, well, for the adults, it would be interesting to play something that they would have heard at a different period of time. And I don't know exactly what the music cues are on this episode. I'd have to go back and look, but I know that there was a very definite decision to make the music at the swingers party very distinct from the music at
Cohen House,
very different from the music that was at the hotel.
Oh, okay.
So that each time you cut from party to party, the music itself would be telling you that you're in a different place and in a different kind of vibe. The music at the swingers party was definitely had much more of that kind of chill out lounge feeling about it. You know,
it was kind of, it almost reminded me of the lobby of the Standard Hotel for some reason. but then just Ride by Jem plays while Sandy is flirting with some other woman. But you know, I thought it was kind of cute. You know, I said to Kelly, I said, you know what? At least it was spicy, and you guys, the characters are having fun, and you don't really see these storylines. And ultimately, Sandy saved the day, and he was very chivalrous, and he played along with her, and then he was like, come on, honey. And I just love how they get over their things with a lot of compassion and love and all that.
And there was never any real chance that they were going to go off with other people. That was
I didn't know what was going to happen. And I was like, are they really going to do this? Like,
boy, you really don't remember the show, do you?
At all. Norman, I'm not lying. I really, like, I'm watching these things for the first time. Like, I've never experienced any of it. But I was really waiting. I was like, oh my God, who are they going to get? Who are they going to be paired with? Are they going to have it? I was very verklempt.
Well, I did not remember that Anna goes back to the Cohen house. Like, that was a total surprise to me.
And let me tell you, I was pissed. Like, watching it, I was jealous. I was like, you little sneaky fuckhead. No, I was like, really, like, I got jealous watching. And I'm like, oh my God, you're not Summer. Like, this is not your life. Like, calm down.
That triangle was so well crafted on the show. I loved that whole Seth, Summer, Anna triangle throughout season one. I thought that really had a lot of, there was another musical choice I made. I can't remember which episode it was in, but there were two versions of the same song, which is a song called Caravan. And I would play one orchestration of it for Anna and one orchestration of it for Summer. So it was, I can't remember what episode it is, but it might be in one of the ones that's coming up soon, where every time he would bounce back and forth between Anna and Summer, there would be a completely different orchestration of the song. And that was fun to do stuff like that, because I would take those things to Josh and say, what do you think of this? Would this work for you if we always played this version with whenever we saw Summer, and we play this version whenever we see Anna? And so there's a lot of real eclectic musical choices. It wasn't all just new bands. It was pulling things. When I did my the episode that I first directed, The Risky Business, we actually got the Risky Business score and used the Risky Business score in the episode. So it was extremely exciting to be able to think outside the box with those kinds of things and use music to tell the story. So I'm glad you picked up on that music in the swingers party, because I almost said the swingles party. You like a swingle? I almost said the swingles party.
Well,
where,
you are explaining to us the perfect example of how your creativity, your artistry lended to this audiovisual experience that that our fans love so much. And and that's why it's so important that you come on the show and explain these things, because we know that they're there and it's such a magical emotional ride that we take the audience on. But having it explained is such a gift.
Yeah, I always say a well-directed episode of television is if you can turn down the sound and track all the emotional beats of the story. You may not track all the plot points or all the exposition, but you'll understand the emotions. You'll understand what the emotional line of the story is. And I certainly think that's true with almost every episode of the OC. And that's one of the things that I think Josh writes to a visual style. There's a real visual component to the show that you don't see on a lot of other shows. A lot of other shows where there's just a lot of talk oftentimes will play well if you're hearing it all, but not necessarily if you turn down the sound. But if you turn down the sound on any episode of the OC, you can track who likes who, who's upset with who is in love with who. And that's certainly true on this episode that we're talking about. If you turn down the sound on this episode, you understand the parties you're at, you understand the relationship of the characters to one another, you understand the things that they're worried about, the things that they're upset with, the swingers party, the way that it's structured so that it gets tighter and tighter and tighter, the way that you are tracking the various ladies at the party, Summer and Anna and Marissa, just how they're positioned in the frame, just even the fact that you see Summer sitting with a guy on the balcony at the party and you don't even see his face. It's just you're just looking at the back of his head and it doesn't matter because it's only about what Summer's feeling at that point. All of those decisions that Michael Fresco made as the director were quite extraordinary, I think, in terms of telling the story visually such that it passes my test. If you can turn down the sound and watch it and really feel the story, then it's, in my mind, it's a well-directed episode.
Yeah, the whole ending sequence of this episode in particular, you know, the whole Kirsten walking into Sandy in the bedroom, you know, hands her his watch, she has her nightie on, that thing, and then Seth and Anna making out, Summer kisses the Tulsa dude, and it's sad that he's not Seth Cohen. She even says it. And then, of course, the monumental moment that was my personal favorite, and I think a lot of other people's favorite, was just the kiss followed by the thank you in response to Ryan saying, "I love you" back, which was well played on Marissa's end.
There is something funny about that sequence. I was always trying to. I shot a lot of the footage of Newport Beach from the air. Mm-hmm. We took a helicopter out. Of course, the day we took the helicopter out, it was very cloudy. So you'll probably notice that Newport Beach looks like it's very gray throughout the run of the show. But I didn't have any night footage, and I really wanted to have a night shot up above the Four Seasons Hotel down in Newport Beach. And they were telling me, like, there's just no way you can get that. And so we ended up using stock footage that we had from Fastlane. So actually there's this shot as Ryan is driving to the Four Seasons Hotel. There's this shot you see of the Tower Hotel on Sunset Boulevard. It's not in Newport Beach at all. It's just a random shot of the Tower Hotel because we needed some hotel shot. And they kept sending me these stock footage shots of just the front of hotels. I was like, no, it's got to be something from the air. It's got to be something that's really expansive and looks really beautiful. And so there's this aerial shot over the top of the Tower Hotel that it's wrong.
It's wrong. Did we build the set of the penthouse or?
Yeah, that was a set. Okay. That was, I remember it was a huge set. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the reasons why that Oliver storyline went on for several episodes was because it had to justify the cost of that set.
Oh, how funny. Right.
It was quite a large set. Yeah.
How funny. Well, I mean, this was just such an awesome episode. I mean, you did such an amazing job editing it. And it's just really fun to revisit it and talk about it.
Yeah.
We have quiz questions for you to answer. Let's see if you can answer these. What are Marissa's New York? It's NY. And I'm like, New York. What are Marissa's New Year's resolutions? I'll give you a hint. There's only one that is noted.
I don't remember. I'm sorry.
I wouldn't have either. You're with me now.
To join Friendster? No, it wasn't that.
To go on TRL? To eat more vegetables.
Would never have gotten that. So it's good I didn't guess.
Okay. What are Kirsten and Sandy's original New Year's plans?
To eat at the Arches.
Yes.
Right. And then watch a ball drop. The ball drop.
Okay, and then...
Well, I decided not to go there.
We can't help ourselves. What is Marissa drinking at Oliver's?
Ginger ale?
No. Do you want to try another? You have another guess?
Club soda?
A virgin mojito.
He kept saying
virgin
it.
Mojito.
Mojito, mojito, mojito.
I thought he was just tempting her with mojitos. I didn't remember that she actually had a virgin mojito.
Yes, he made it. Yep. Yep.
Yep.
Don't worry. I would not have gotten a single one right. And I was impressed that you knew it was Dinner at the Arches.
Dinner at the Arches, which is a real restaurant. Yes.
That was another funny scene, the whole car talking back to them, because that was very new then. Cars talking back to you, like
the GPS lady.
Telling you which way to go. Yes, yes.
I don't want to argue with the GPS lady. No, that was a very funny one. Also, that Peter, he walks in on a threesome in his bedroom. And
which
repeats
is a,
exactly.
Which is a callback to, it's a callback to the pilot. Pilot. Yeah. Right.
Wait,
yeah.
You also wrote there was a blooper. The door wouldn't open when Ryan's running
there's
Marissa for the kiss?
When he runs to the door, there's a famous blooper in the slow-mo as Ben runs to the door. The POV of the door to the penthouse, it didn't open. Right. And he slams into it and kind of dramatically falls.
I remember
it didn't.
That.
It didn't open.
I have a question for you guys. Do you know where they shot that hotel lobby sequence?
No.
No.
Where?
At the Marriott hotel that was right next to the studio. So
I was going to say Marriott but no.
It was not exactly the Four Seasons.
Nope.
But it was,
Marriott, randomly, not even on the beach, in Manhattan.
Yeah. It's like the Marriott in Manhattan Beach near the studio.
How funny.
Right.
Little tidbit. Yeah. I like that little fun fact. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Yeah. I could come up with a whole bunch of questions that you guys wouldn't be able to answer, so...
Norman is a wealth of information.
Absolutely.
He's a film historian as well, as far as I'm concerned. So he's also my resource. If I ever have a question, you and Matt, I've asked questions of for the for our podcast, and I appreciate it.
Any way I can help you guys, let me know, because it's fun. It's fun to revisit this period of time in my life.
One more thing that I wanted to make note of: David Whaley Foundation, in honor of your late husband, that helps artists. Do you want to talk about that really quick? Because I think it's an important thing.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Appreciate you bringing it up. Yeah, the David Whaley Foundation is just to support artists. It's David felt a real passion for the arts, and he felt a real passion for buying the work of others. And he also felt a real passion for teaching. And so when he passed away, I was just looking for a way to give honor to his life. And I felt the best way I could do that was just to create something that would continue to support the things that were important to him. And so we've given out 11 grants so far to various artists. We've given out some grants to artist teachers, because a lot of artists support themselves by teaching. And so we've given grants to support teachers so that they can just take some time off to paint or whatever they want to do. And also to some mid-career artists who just maybe haven't gotten the recognition that they have. And now we're moving more into supporting students and creating some scholarships. So it's just been a way for me to kind of give real honor to his life, because he was the best person I ever knew. Aww. And, you know, I'm just grateful that I can, pay it forward, because that's what he would want. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you.
Yes, well, you are an example of a beautiful human being, and
absolutely,
we are so in debt to you, because you made our experience that much more rich.
Shall we listen to some voicemails, Mindy?
We shall, Miss Bilson.
Let her rip.
Hi, my name is Alex. I live in New York City. I'm a huge OC fan. I was actually class of 06, and I was watching this along with the show as I was in high school. I had a huge, huge Seth Cohen crush. All the bands at the Bait Shop, I loved those bands and I was also seeing them. Sadly, I had a friend a lot like Marissa. Anyway, it was just very near and dear to my life experience and loved it. So in a happy accident, I actually started rewatching it for the first time right when you guys started this podcast. And I'm loving this podcast. You guys are doing amazing. So my question is, in my rewatch, I have been noticing how much the business has changed and that nowadays I feel like so many different body types are represented on TV. And it wasn't that way back when you guys were shooting. And I'm wondering if you guys felt any pressure to be super thin and to look a certain way. And maybe you two didn't, because I'm kind of willing to bet you guys have kind of naturally slender frames. But I'm wondering if there was any of that going around on set or in the culture or kind of what you guys remember about that and how you feel like the business has changed since.
Whew. Woo. Interesting question. First of all, I love that she's so relate. I mean, yes, the OC is so relatable to everyone. We all know somebody in real life that were similar to characters on the show. I think she's correct. Rachel, yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. That, I mean, I come from a slim family, but look, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't aware of our, you know, this vessel, so to speak, is our commodity. And yes, there's absolutely, I know for sure that producers, when they hire you, it's hopefully for your acting skills, and but that also is the, you know, physically it's the character that they imagine. And there definitely is pressure to maintain a certain thing, aesthetic, that I was hired for, I guess, you know, do you
but
agree?
I think that there is truth to how things have changed and there's just more, you know, aware of body positive things and everything, which I think is great. Yeah. I mean, that definitely was the case back in the day. And I've heard stories of people where they're like, you need to lose 10 pounds or whatever it is. And I'm just so happy that that has changed because it's so unhealthy. And for me, when we were doing the OC, I was so young that my mental state was way more like, I didn't think about that as much. But I guess I'm fortunate that I'm a tiny person, but I'm child size. It's a little embarrassing just because height and whatnot. But, you know, I just think the emphasis on that is, I'm happy that it's changed. I'll just say that.
Well, I do remember kind of having, admittedly, a freak out when I opened the script and it says Julie's in a bikini and she's running to save Caleb. And I was like, no, the girls, Rachel and Misha can be in bikinis, not me. But yeah, there's a little vanity in that. And I think the other thing is, you know, they've always said that, oh, by the time you're 38, your career's over. And I think I've done a lot of personal work on, it's like, nope, this is me, 52, hire me, not whatever. Or and having a good attitude about just being who I am in the moment. You know, it's not, I don't feel, I do things now for my health and my mind, you know, eating right, exercising. It's just what makes me feel good. So, and if I feel good, I think I look good. That's what.
Yeah.
So good. Absolutely. Question.
Yeah.
But yes, I think we embrace all body types now.
Thank you. Better, for your question. More.
Hi, my name's Rebecca and I'm from Toronto, Canada. And I have a couple of questions for you. My first question is, do you ever feel self-conscious when you're in front of the camera? And if so, how do you overcome those feelings of self-consciousness? And my second question is, do you have any tips for how to be a good actor? Thank you so much.
Ooh, these are tough ones.
We're burying our souls.
Burying our souls. First of all, shout out to Toronto. I have spent you have too, Mindy.
Oh boy, yeah.
You're very familiar with Toronto. Little Timmy's. Thank you T-town. For calling.
Timmy Nolan.
Timmy Nolan?
What? Isn't that the coffee
Tim Hortons,
place?
Tim Hortons.
Tim Hortons. God, what am I thinking?
Timmy Nolan's been a while. The bar in Toluca Lake.
Whoops.
Sorry, a little off track here. Gosh, self-conscious in front of the camera. I mean, yeah, well, you were just talking about it, Mindy, even like running in a bikini or whatever. Like these are things that you think about. Just, I mean, sex scenes are always a little awkward.
I think there's a bravery thing at some point. Being self-conscious is not a good thing for an actor. If that comes up, to believe is brave, and you've got to be able to relax. It's definitely not a positive thing to be self-conscious.
Right.
Yes. It kind of can impede the acting, the performance, I would think, right?
Yeah. And what did she ask tips on being a good actor? Was that right?
A good actor. I think we touched quite a bit on that. I mean, I think really, honestly, one of my first tips, because especially if you're a guest star or a co-star and you're not a series regular where everyone's really comfortable, but if you're a guest, there's a lot of nerves. You might not know everybody, and that can be kind of uncomfortable. Know your dialogue, like the ABCs. Know it backwards and forwards. You just heard Norman say that going up on your dialogue, minutes can turn into hours. And if you just know it so well and be overprepared, that you're never that person that wasted time on set because you couldn't get your dialogue. That's my first thought.
Yeah. And also, I think a big thing, which is what I was told when I started out, was listen. Listen to the other actor, like really hear what they're saying. And that goes in hand with what you're saying, Mindy, because if you already know what you have to say, you know, you have it down, you're able and capable to actually listen and be present in the scene. And I think that's probably the first thing that I was told. And I try to go with it always.
I agree. Listen and know your dialogue.
And thank you for your questions.
And thank you. Well, this was such a pleasure. Norman, you know, maybe Josh, Stephanie, Norman, Matt, the directors, they just know so many details mm-hmm. about our show, and they all contributed so much to the experience that is the OC. And I really appreciate their time. And I just love hearing these conversations and reconnecting with everybody.
Me too. It's been so much fun. And thank you everyone for listening to our little podcast show. Follow, rate, and review Welcome to the OC Bitches wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you like to watch us, check it out on YouTube. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And bye.
Till next time. Goodbye.
See you next week.
Close your eyes. It's time to discover what starting and growing your own business feels like. Whether your business is bedsheets or skincare, Shopify's with you every step of the way. Now, open your eyes. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a free trial at shopify.com/podcast22. Shopify.com/podcast22.
Hi, everyone. It's Rabia Chaudhry.
And I'm Ellen Marsh.
And we have a new podcast called Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case. As you know, I am a very smart lawyer.
You are. You're so well-respected in the entire world. You know everything.
Thank you so much.
And as you know, I'm a famous Broadway star. Gorgeous. I sing like a nightingale.
Well, yes. At least that's what your mom says. Just kidding. This is Ellen Marsh.
And I'm Rabia.
But we are teaming up to bring you a show like you have never heard before.
True crime meets talk show. Nobody's done it. We're going to do it. We're going to do the impossible. And it's the two things that I love. Ellen, I think you'll like it too.
What? True crime and talking?
Yeah.
I'm there. Every other week, we will have a guest talking about whatever true crime case they are obsessed with. We have a list, everything from the Lacey Peterson murder.
Yeah, some of the most famous cases you've ever heard of, obviously, like JonBenet Ramsey, the West Memphis Three.
Chris Watts, Khalif Browder.
Elisa Lam, Madeleine McCain.
Sandra Bland, the Springfield Three. The list goes on and on. But they are all cases that you know, and we are going to dive in deep with someone else and just talk about them.
No. We're going to solve the case, Ellen.
That's right. We're going to solve the case. So subscribe to Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case wherever you get your podcasts.